Welcome to the Spotlight Report, part of Erie Insights, a resource dedicated to discussions regarding optics and science. I'm your host, Logan Graves, at the University of Arizona. Our website is erieinsights.com, where you can find this episode and comment or subscribe. Additionally, you can find our other podcast series, as well as articles and other resources. Our email address is mail@erieinsights.com. We would love to hear from you.
Hello everyone, so today we're going to talk with Maham Aftab, one of our lecturers today. And she's going to graduate soon, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, so how do you go to the field of optics?
Basically, I got my undergrad in electrical engineering, or something very close to electrical engineering. And one of our specializations was lasers and optoelectronics. So I was kind of introduced to it then, and I found it very interesting. I sort of started like dabbling into optics then. And I've always been very fascinated with astronomical optics and instrumentation. So that kind of got me interested in this field.
Well, that is quite broad. Yeah, a broad view of the interesting area.
Yeah.
And you had previous higher education experience before you joined PhD. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So after my undergrad, I got admitted into a scholarship from the Erasmus Mundus program, which is a European Union higher education program. And in this program, I did two degrees. I got my first master's in applied physics from TU Delft in the Netherlands, and my second master's in optics, matter and plasma from École Polytechnique and Institut d'Optique in Paris, France. And then I got my master's in optical sciences from the University of Arizona, and I am close to getting my PhD in optical sciences from here as well.
Yeah, so speaking of broad backgrounds, so we're going to talk to you today about your paper that you published, actually that I'm on it, so.
Yeah, so basically you two are so familiar with that.
Well,
so maybe you two can just talk about that and just like, okay, cool.
Yeah, I think because it ties in so nicely with a lot of deflectometry work.
It does, yeah. But the paper we're going to talk about is using a new modal integration technique you came up with. Before we get into it, can you just talk about what we mean when we talk about integrating data? Like, why do we need to do that, and what would we do before your method?
Right. So basically, a lot of optical metrology actually relies on measuring the slope or the gradient of surfaces or wavefronts instead of directly measuring the surface or wavefront. And of course, once you measure the slopes, you need to have some method to get or reconstruct the surface or the wavefront from the measured data. So there are two broad methods to reconstruct this data. One are zonal methods, and one of the zonal methods that's very popular, for example, is the Southwell method. And especially if you talk about deflectometry, because a lot of my work was in the context of deflectometry. So deflectometry traditionally used and still continues to use the Southwell zonal integration method. But of course, there are modal methods that already exist, but I introduced a new kind of polynomial basis set and an accompanying modal integration method, which is basically to reconstruct this measured slope data.
And I just want to jump in because actually, Zhang, you should be the one to talk about it, but when we fabricate optics, a lot of the times, when you think about it, they're going to be circular, and they're going to have common symmetric errors, either due to alignment, misalignment, I should say, or even sometimes you'll have tool pattern errors or types of things.
Yeah.
So historically, like Maham said, what we'll do is use something called Southwell integration, which is a zonal integration. And we can talk a little bit more about what zonal means versus modal, but we would use that, or if we were doing the modal approaches, like you said, we would use Zernike modes.
and I think that we've talked about it before on the podcast, but all of this is based around the fundamental idea that we are dealing with an optic that's circular, that's continuous, and that will have somewhat symmetric errors across it, which I think, Shangyi, you can talk about is not always the case for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So basically during the process, you always know what the goal is, but it's not the case. The case is you cannot always align the thing so well. So you always got certain misfit. And that is not because you are not careful enough. It's because during the fabrication, your tool gonna change, definitely. Mm-hmm. So as time goes by, if you do not measure it frequently, it always change to another shape.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing is it's not, the fabrication process is not okay, I just continuously do this, it's finally we'll get into the shape you wanna go. We always separate into several process to go to the desired shape. So we may set for the first step, the shape we wanna look like is definitely not the exact shape. It may have some weird shape on the surface, but it is okay because it is what we wanted to do. And then we may think of some easier way to treat this situation until we not we do this to the last step.
Right.
And since you mentioned the Zernike polynomials, I think I should mention that Zernike polynomials are great. They represent balanced aberrations across circular apertures in rotationally symmetric systems.
Mm-hmm.
So they have always been important. They continue to be very important. If we are thinking about balanced aberrations and if our focus is on that, especially for circular apertures, of course, it's recommended to use Zernike polynomials, or there are other polynomial sets like annular polynomials, hexagonal, etc., that again represent balanced aberrations across those aperture types for rotationally symmetric systems. But in the context of deflectometry, we aren't really talking about rotationally symmetric systems, and our objectives are a little different. They're not really aberration balancing and those kind of things.
Yeah, because these days the freeform optics and the aspherics
optics
are quite popular. Yeah, I think they took the dominant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're becoming very prominent, and especially a lot of deflectometry work that we do focuses on those kind of optics.
Right, and I think that kind of frames it well for our listeners that if they, not only if they aren't in this lab, but even kind of a specific subset of optics, it's easy to forget that the driving message right now in fabrication is, okay, we want freeform optics, we can come up with crazy systems and get really great performance in virtual reality, in telescopes, in microscopes, in displays, and whatever. And like Zhang Yu said, the challenge to getting there not only is how do you fabricate it physically, but how do you actually verify that you fabricated it?
Yeah.
Or as you're fabricating it, am I doing the right thing?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think one of the challenges with freeform optics still remains to how to mathematically represent the surfaces correctly.
That's true.
As well as how do you analyze them? How do you, really define the surfaces and measure them accurately?
Right. And that's where integration of either slopes or wavefront slopes comes in. So, So can you just describe what is your modal method?
Mm-hmm. So basically, very simply speaking, it is a gradient polynomial method. So basically, I use Chebyshev polynomials as the scalar basis set. And from two-dimensional Chebyshev polynomials of the first kind, I took their gradients and came up with a polynomial set that represents the slope data directly. So it's a gradient polynomial set. And as I mentioned, it can fit the measured data directly in the gradient domain. Chebyshev polynomials are well known to be orthogonal across rectangular apertures. And my model polynomials that I call the G polynomials, G just for gradients, they are also, I orthonormalize them for rectangular apertures. So of course they are great for rectangular apertures, but because you can generate many polynomials, you can also fit other kinds of apertures with them.
So I think that nicely leads into why do we need it? You said that we had Southwell integration, or zonal integration, I should say. Mm-hmm. We had previous modal methods. Why yours?
Right. So one of the drawbacks with a lot of modal methods is that you cannot generate a very large number of polynomials. A lot of the times, the gradients that you get from your scalar basis set, like Zernike's or any other basis set, they aren't actually orthogonal. And so you have to use a method to orthogonalize them. The relationship, because it's very important to find out the relation between the scalar polynomial coefficients and vector polynomial coefficients, since you need them to eventually get your surface or wavefront. So that relationship is not that straightforward also. So you get into a lot of like computational heavy calculations, and you get into a lot of error sources as well. Whereas with the polynomial set that I generated, it's pretty straightforward. You have orthogonality. There's also a very, very straightforward relationship between the scalar and vector polynomials. And the way these polynomials are generated, we have a very easy recursive generation for the polynomials. So you can generate literally hundreds of thousands of polynomials. And this is very important, in particular, if you are really concerned about the mid to high spatial frequency of your optic. Because you need a lot of polynomials in order to accurately represent the mid to high spatial frequencies.
So you opened up a number of things that I want to dig into, like orthogonality, the recursive nature. But before we do that, I want Xiangyu, the resin expert, to describe what do you mean, what is this idea of low and mid and high spatial frequency errors?
Okay. Yeah, when I heard the mid to high spatial frequency, I feel like I got this hint, like, you're gonna ask me this question. So basically the low frequency is like you see some stuff, like, what example should be the best? Like you see a football, like what I was gonna say, okay, you see a football, and you know what's the shape, by your naked eyes, but definitely for optics, you cannot just observe by your naked eye, but so you got an idea of what the shape it is. So you got a rough idea of what the shape it is, and into optics, it's like we can measure the surface profile. We know what is it. Where you can think you got a contact styler, and it contact it, and it goes across the surface, and multiple line you can fit it, and you know what is the surface is that basically fit with low frequency. Mm-hmm. As for the mid to high frequency, it goes to another. It goes to another field of view. So you can feel like, okay, I'm zooming into a small area, and they definitely is not for football. Okay, let's go to football again. It's not that clear.
Xiangyu's really ready for the football game.
Yeah, because that is a game I never understand.
Perfect. Yeah. So you decided to understand the football itself.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
It's okay. So you want to know, okay, zoom into this area, what is the shape look like? Okay, so now it must go some high point and low point, like peak to valley. But yeah, so... And you're going to see a lot of rough stuff on there if you got a stylus go across the line. And basically that kind of stuff fit with the mid frequency.
And I think when I explain it to friends or family, one of the easiest things for people to grasp is like, oh, okay, well, if it's shaped wrong, the light might come in focus at the wrong point. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like the low order stuff. Mm-hmm. The mid order... right. So when we're speaking about mid to high spatial frequencies, you can start to think that the like Xiangyu explained, I mean, there's going to be more minor variations across your focus spot that deviate it from the ideal focus, which is an airy disk for a circular aperture. And then you get into high spatial frequencies, and it's going to cause very weird patterns or minor scratches or stuff digs on the mirror. And what was interesting is that we just completed a mirror that, for me, was the first time I ever saw a spec for surface roughness, which is usually what we think about when we talk about high spatial frequencies. And that was the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope. Mm-hmm. It's so much easier to just say DKIS, and I hate having to say the whole thing every time. But that was one of the first times that we had to do, like, oh, is it smooth enough?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why we need to know, and like you said, modal methods are really good at low spatial frequencies, mm-hmm. because it might not be easy to generate enough modes to fit high spatial frequencies. Mm-hmm. But high spatial frequencies are important. So how do you manage to make so many? You said you can make up to 100,000 or more pretty easily. How do you do that?
That's the nature of the polynomials and their relationship. So math, I guess, is the answer. Kids focus on math. Actually, I do really want to get something...
Yeah, no, please.
On record.
Sure,
which
sure.
is that sometimes, like, on Facebook or somewhere, I'll see people, you know, like, sharing equations from algebra or something like that, and saying, like, see, we never needed it when we were growing up. And I look and I'm like, no, I need them every day in my work that actually, like, goes into, you know, real life works.
Yeah, yeah. I've been thinking about it too recently. We're totally off topic.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about it because I'm kind of pushing back on this idea that you should only learn stuff that you need.
Yeah.
I think that just learning stuff not only teaches you how to learn more broadly,
right.
like even outside of what you're learning, you're at mm-hmm. least learning how to learn, but also it just makes you a more well-rounded person.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I remember my mom always telling me that whatever you do, whether you get into... you know, like something more artistic or medicine, whatever, like you are going to study math.
Right, right.
Yeah. Like, I will not let you draw mm-hmm. math.
yeah.
And I think, yeah, as you said, that it maybe doesn't directly translate into your mm-hmm. work, but I think sometimes it gives you, like, a logical thinking.
Yeah.
But what I specifically wanted to say was that, you know, it's not that the math that we're taught will never have real-life applications.
Mm-hmm.
It does. And it's not just in the minds of some crazy physicists and mathematicians. No,
mm-hmm.
you have very real, very nice, practical applications that directly use a lot of your math.
Yeah, definitely.
So what is the topic again? I forgot.
So we were talking about how you make so many polynomials, and you said math.
But then it's all about math.
Yeah, but you don't have to go into super detail. I'm going to link the paper so that if our audience is really interested, they can read into it. But just kind of what about this polynomial set kind of allows for that? I mean, without too much detail.
Sure. So there are a number of factors in this. The Skitter basis set is already a good enough basis set to start with. Then, as I mentioned previously, the fact that you get orthogonal polynomials when you take the gradients of the two-dimensional Chebyshev polynomials of the first kind. And then I had to use the definition, or I linked it, which I explained in the paper, to the definition of the Chebyshev polynomials of the second kind. But you can find a very easy and straightforward recursive relationship to generate the scalar, of course. Everybody knows, I mean, everybody who's interested in this topic knows the recursive relationships for Chebyshev scalar polynomials. But for my gradient polynomials also, you can find easy recursive relationships. And also, when we checked, you know, the how correct the polynomials generated from the recursive relationship versus directly was, it gave a very, very close match. So that's pretty good. And then because of this direct orthogonality and everything, as I mentioned again, that you have a very straightforward relationship between the scalar and vector polynomials. So all of these things make it computationally very easy. Mm-hmm. And it takes out a lot of extra steps that you might need to do like Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization or something like that with other gradient or vector polynomial basis sets. So that makes it very straightforward, very easy, and more correct also in some ways.
So this is one of my favorite things about it. Is like I think it's almost elegant. And we talked to Sam Nirenberg. You know, he finds beauty or art in math and science, but he's a character, so only he can do that to his level. To his level, I should say. Okay. And not only many people can, but he manages to find it in almost everything. But the fact that you were able to see the connection between, okay, well, the scalar set for Chebyshev polynomials can be recursively generated, and that we can make a connection between the gradient to the scalar and maintain that recursive nature is just really incredible, especially because it then fits into such a practical need, which is like we need a bunch of polynomials to fit high frequency data. And we've hinted or alluded to it before, but for other sets, they might not be able to be recursively generated. So what that means practically is that unless you have a graduate student whose dissertation is how many polynomials they can write out over 5 years, you can't fit high frequency data.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just how many polynomials you can write out. Like, sometimes generating, because a lot of the polynomial basis set, even some scalar basis set, don't really have nice recursive relationships to begin with. So unless you have extreme computational power, it's very difficult to write them out. And especially when you have something like, so this basis set is orthogonal across rectangular apertures, which means that if you change the aspect ratio, or you have to factor in this aspect ratio, so if your length and width changes, the numbers would change. So including those kind of things, those kind of aspect ratios, and then having like some way to generate them is crazy otherwise.
Right.
And of course, you start accumulating errors when you start like going into assumptions and those kind of things.
Yeah, which none of us ever make in academic papers.
Never.
So you hinted to it. You didn't hint to it. You just flat out said that they have the very nice property that they're orthogonal.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just kind of give a rundown for what that means?
So there are properties of data fitting with orthogonality. But also, so like, you know, lesser noise or lesser noise propagation. But also, one of the nice things about orthogonality is that the coefficients then of the polynomials are kind of meaningful, because if you have an orthonormal data set, and no matter how many polynomials, number of polynomials you generate, the value of the coefficients doesn't change. So if I generated, for instance, with the Zernike polynomial, circular aperture, unit circular aperture, whether I generated the first 10 polynomials or whether I generated the first 100 polynomials, the common ones, the first 10 in this case, their coefficients are not going to change.
Right.
So you can have a meaningful value associated with them. And this is one of the things that we're actually exploring in Maya and Logan's next project, which is concerning systematic errors from deflectometry based systems based on a derivative. I don't mean it in a mathematical sense, derivative, but the another polynomial basis set.
Right. So we now have a modal method. You can recursively generate a very large number of terms, and it's orthogonal over a rectangular aperture. What did you do to demonstrate that this worked?
The polynomial.
Yeah, in terms of like how did you test it, or what data sets did you use?
So of course, I started by testing it on simulated data, because in that case, you know the actual truth. So I simulated a lot of data sets that were different kinds or different kinds of apertures, and I generated the gradients and then fit them. And of course, to do a sanity check, I also used other methods, other polynomial methods, as well as the Southwell zonal method that was already tried and tested, to see if everything was fine. And then I compared it against the simulated data. So that way I got idea of the accuracy, especially because one of the other properties, nice properties of this modal method is that in the presence of fiducials or markers, such as fiducials that you place on the optic during deflectometry measurements, or if you have blockers in your aperture like telescopes, spiders, obscurations, if you have like a scratch on the mirror or something, a lot of the times other integration methods may not give you a good estimation of the reconstruction, especially around these fiducials, markers, scratches, etc. But the modal method fits it very nicely. You might need to use more polynomials, but clearly that's usually not a problem with this data set. And so you're able to get a nice estimate or a better, more accurate reconstruction. So, of course, I modeled that also using different fiducials, scratches, all of those things, varying sizes, varying types, all kinds of things. And then, of course, you need noise. I even like generated different kinds of random noise, amounts of noise. So I have all of those in the paper. Those are simulations. But of course, you also want to see if it works for real data. So the mirror that you mentioned, the Daniel K. Noe Solar Telescope or DKS primary mirror metrology data was compared against the well-tried and tested Southwell integration method. Which in this case we take it as a reference because we don't know the absolute truth. It's not a simulation, it's real data. So we use that as a reference, and then I checked it against the modal method, and that's how I tested out.
And you gave some examples. I want to hear how it performed. I know how it performed. Hopefully our listeners want to hear how it performed. But you did give some examples such as fiducials, missing data regions, etc. And just to be sure that our listeners understand, because again, we look at this all the time, these are not like, oh, maybe you might have this. These are things that you do have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You might have, unfortunately, you might have a chip on the edge of the mirror. That means missing data. You might have a scratch in the mirror. That means missing data. Mm-hmm. We have put fiducials on.
Right. You might have to somehow put some kind of aperture or something that blocks some part of the mirror.
Right.
And whether it's something really big like spiders or centered obscuration, or if it's something much smaller. But yeah, and it doesn't have to be something permanent also, as you guys know that during the deflectometry metrology runs, we temporarily put fiducials. They don't have to, they actually shouldn't remain on the mirror.
Right.
But you have to reconstruct data when you're doing that.
Right. Yeah. And as you said, the Southwell zonal method, it's a zonal method. Trying to integrate inside of a zone where there's missing data or discontinuities, you're going to get errors in your integration.
Yeah, which propagates throughout.
Right. And this isn't like 100%, this is not a bash on Southwell integration. This is the standard method that has been used since the 80s. This paper is
I'll put a link. I think like early 1980s.
I'll put a link to the Southwell paper as well, because we were talking about this.
Right. No, so actually, we are not trying to claim that this modal method is like absolutely for every situation, everything is just the absolute best. There's nothing that comes close. Not at all, of course. And I think anybody who claims that for any generic method, I don't know how they can claim that, actually. So I would like to say that different surface reconstruction methods have their advantages and disadvantages, and it depends on what you're interested in. For example, you could have a situation where you don't really care about the mid to high spatial frequencies. Or you could have like situations where time is of utmost importance.
Right.
Or where you don't really care, or maybe you do have access to very high computation power. things like that. So you have to actually really look at the situation, look at what your system is, look at what you're interested in. As I mentioned before, if you're talking about balanced aberrations for a rotationally symmetric optical system, then Zernike polynomials are good for representing that. So yeah, like what your end goals are, this is just another tool in the vast set of surface reconstruction methods. But at the same time, it does have a lot of advantages. It does have a lot of situations. And other than very typical metrology situations, there is another thing that I'm working on with one of our lab mates that also uses this polynomial set that hopefully you'll hear about sometime soon.
Right.
So there can be like a lot of different applications, but you need to, but you should be aware, if this is something that you work in and that's important to you, should be aware of the different techniques and then kind of choose which one suits you best.
Right. And before we get into the results of that comparison, I just want to give a little background for our listeners that we talked about the DCIST earlier that we measured surface roughness, but this thing was the smooth, we call it a super smooth mirror, is this the smoothest, largest mirror ever made or something, something like that.
Yeah, the largest ever solar telescope.
Right. I'll put a link up to the metrology methods, but why that's important is because we use deflectometry in conjunction with interferometry, in conjunction with very small sub-aperture deflectometry and other methods to
microfinish topography,
right, to really verify, okay, this thing works. But the Southwell integration was integral in that. So if you're comparing now, okay, this was the cutting edge when this was done, including all the way up to super high spatial frequency things, this represents an ideal data set to compare to. So how did it compare? The modal method relative to the Southwell of the DCIST.
Right. So it compared really well. Of course, we looked at the general error of fitting. It was very, very close. But also a very interesting comparison we did was to actually really look at the mid to high spatial frequencies. So what we did was that we processed, filtered data using a high-pass filter from Southwell reconstruction versus the modal reconstruction. And I have a really nice figure that I'm very proud of in the paper. It shows progressively how, as you increase the number of polynomials, you get closer and closer to the just this high-pass filter data. So that shows two things. First of all, that the modal polynomial achieves this good representation of mid to high spatial frequencies. And the other thing it highlights is that how many polynomials you would need. I think I did the comparison up to 20,000 or 30,000, something like that. Yeah, so you literally need like so many polynomials for this. So yeah, it compared really, really well to Southwell. In terms of simulated data also, it was pretty close for various kinds of situations. In fact, in terms of accuracy, in some cases it performed a little bit better. Maybe it was a little slower if you needed many, many polynomials, like thousands, but it performed quite well.
Could you give a ballpark estimate for how long it might take?
So it really depends on many factors. What size of the data set you have, how many polynomials you're interested in. Again, depending on, you know, your spatial frequencies, if there's something else, if, you know, you don't exactly have a rectangular aperture. Like I give the example, one of the figures is a freeform surface generated over an aperture that has rounded corners, and it also has spiders and a central obscuration that covers a lot of the area. So yeah, like all of these things, it will really depend on all of that.
Okay. And also just for our listeners, if they aren't in our field, spiders is referring to mounts that hold some central.
It's a secondary mirror.
Yeah.
Right. Or, yeah.
Not physical spiders.
Yeah, sorry, I should have.
It's
a very common.
It's something that we do all the time. You take for granted,
right?
Information that you know. I was really blown away not only with how well it could fit the high frequency data, but with how well it was able to reconstruct around missing data or fiducials or
very high changes in the slope.
Right. I really recommend our listeners, if they're interested, to go look at the paper, because like I was saying, that I think it's really incredible how well it fits, like you were saying, around fiducials or apertures or spiders, and missing data. And practically for us, it's important because we do have missing data, as we said sometimes, and it is a problem with at least the version of Southwell integration that we're using. So this was a nice additional tool that we can use
Like to mention that, of course, there are continuous improvements being made, for instance, with the Southwell integration method as well.
Right.
There's always those things, but in many of our comparisons, at least for the kind of implementations we have, modal fitting was, in many cases, a little bit better.
Right. And then, so the last thing before we move on, was there anything unexpected or particularly challenging or particularly exciting about the process that you encountered
For this paper? Yeah, there were some challenges, unexpected things as well. We started out with a particular set of goals, and I think some of the advantages of the modal polynomial fitting, as well as some of its other applications, particularly some applications outside deflectometry, were surprisingly good. There were some challenges regarding the publication process because of maybe some differences in opinion regarding some polynomial data fitting methods.
Well, it's such a new approach, I'm sure. It's publishing a paper is always going to be hard, and when you're publishing something very new or cutting edge, as you rightfully would expect, people are going to really ask to prove that, yeah, this is working.
Right. And I mean, maybe sometimes it's just the way things get translated. Maybe for one person, some of the objectives were a little bit different than what they expected or what they were used to. For somebody else, there could be something else. Maybe some people could think it was a little math intensive. Some people could think it needed a little more mathematical details. This is the nature, as you said, of probably any newer thing, but also research in general, that you might have some unexpected obstacles.
Sure.
Okay, cool. So considering you are almost graduated now, so looking back your graduate student's life, how do you feel like that?
Yeah. Just for my PhD?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Because you got a so broad background.
I'm very happy with my graduate experience. My PhD was not the easiest thing on earth. And I really want to bring attention to the fact, I don't know what other people perceive it to be, but I know that sometimes it can be really, really challenging. And we tend to look at graduate studies, especially in the STEM fields, as people who are doing it are super smart and they're just like flying through it. And I don't think that's true, especially based on my experiences. There are many times that I really struggled. I failed tests. I was There were times I probably disappointed my advisor. There were times that nothing was working. So there were all kinds of situations, and you must remember that if you don't face them, that's great. You know, that's amazing. But there might be times, especially for like a PhD, that you might face these situations over and over and over again. But that doesn't mean that you're not smart enough or hardworking enough or you're not supposed to be here. No, you don't have to let anybody make you feel that way. If you like what you're doing and you're making some kind of progress, then just continue.
Anybody, including yourself. I think that's a very important caveat.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, thank you. That's very true. Yeah, but also you brought a very good point. I think a lot of the times it's a lot about how like mentally strong you are and how passionate you are about what you're doing. If you're, because there are probably going to be lots of times when you're going to really doubt yourself. And I think that's the most difficult thing to get past.
So how did you get past all of it?
For me, it was a lot of interest and love for what I did. Mm-hmm. When I started this research, I remember thinking that I don't really have a math background and it seems to be a lot of math work. But...
How did that moment occur where you said, ooh, this looks like a lot of math here?
No, really. So I was, when I joined this research group, I was given kind of two options of things to work on. One was more in line with what I had been doing. It was more related to like optical design stuff. And actually the master's degree that I had before, my thesis was related to that, and I'd done a lot of work in it, and it's not that I didn't find that work interesting, but I didn't find it that interesting. And this work, although this wasn't really my background, and I thought, I don't know what will come ahead, and I did find a lot of challenges in this work, but it was something that I really liked. The applications and the broader picture also, I think you have to think about that. That was really interesting to me. Of course, I must say that my advisor has been super supportive throughout. So there were times that I was not doing well or I was really doubting myself, and he really encouraged me. And something that personally I didn't do, but I would like to advise other people to do, is to find a community of people around you, and don't be afraid to ask for help or to tell people that you're struggling. You would be surprised at how many people have gone through even more challenging experiences than yourself.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, look back to all our interviews, we feel like different people got all different kind of difficulties through their life.
Yeah, now I talk to many people and I say like, oh, I failed my comprehensive exam, and they're like, oh, me too. Or like, you'd be like, oh yeah, I had like this thing, or my advisor was like mad with me, and they'd be like, oh yeah, yeah, story of my life. And some of those people are like super smart or like doing really well, so it's kind of nice to know that you're not the only one.
After we talked to Chase Salisbury, he had that funny story that you'll be really stressed or things won't be going well, and you'll run into someone and say, like, how's it going? They'll be like, oh, everything's great. And then you feel obligated to say, likewise, everything's also great. So I've been really trying hard when people say, like, how's it going? Be like, man, well, I'm really stressed and, you know, have to get some papers done, and the experiment still isn't perfect. And there's always a brief look of surprise when they go, like, oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah. I mean, also, you shouldn't, like, always feel perpetually stressed too. That's not the way to live life.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, it's important to strike a nice balance between the two things, where you're like happy and you share your positive experiences, but also when things are tough, you have people to share that with.
Yeah,
that's true. You also did a lot of outreach work during these years, right? So
right.
Do you mind just talking about that?
Sure. So I have always been very interested in education, and particularly STEM education, and in particularly STEM education for girls.
Mm.
So I have previously been a part of several nonprofit organizations, such as A World at School or Girl Rising, which work for education for disadvantaged communities all around the world. And here at the College of Optical Sciences, I have been very fortunate to work with the Women in Optics group,
mm-hmm.
Who do amazing work, outreach work, and we've with them or with other amazing groups at the university, I've been able to go to other schools or participate in outreach events, especially, you know, STEM events. Just sometimes it can be really small. I remember going to this school in Arizona where I just got, like, I borrowed these VR glasses, simple VR glasses from the library, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And kids were, like, amazed. And they were like, oh, my God. And, like, you guys do this work? And I don't know how many girls and how many people were so happy and so excited for that.
Were there any particular highs or lows in the graduate experience?
In general?
Yes.
Yeah, many, many lows. Yeah, I mean, you know, with the comprehensive exams, with some publishing,
right,
research,
right, sure.
Those kind of things. Highs, of course, when you get praise.
Going through the border with Daewook.
No, conferences as
yeah,
well. When, especially when other people come up to you and say that they really liked your work, or, you know, when random people, not like random, but
yeah,
like
right.
People you don't really work with ask you about your work, mm-hmm. and yeah, those kind of things. On some job interviews also, people have been kind of impressed with my work or with
mm-hmm.
our lab in general, and of course that's a great feeling.
So there's a ton of other things I want to ask about, but like you said, we're just about out of time for our hour, and you also are going to be finishing your dissertation soon and defending.
Mm-hmm.
So after that,
we'll have
a second one. Before we sign off, are there any pieces of advice that you would give to people considering graduate school,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe who are early on in it? Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I always say is that, and I think I talked about it earlier, that you have to be passionate about what you're doing. In general in life, that really helps you, but I feel like in graduate school, because, you know, you don't get paid a lot, you work really hard, it might take a lot of time. That's the other thing, like, expect it to sometimes take much longer than you were planning to. And again, that doesn't mean that you didn't work hard or you weren't smart. That's just the nature of research. Or sometimes there can be other factors that can make it longer or harder than you originally intended it to. But I think to be successfully able to do it and be happy at the end of it and not be bitter about your experience, you really have to like what you're doing. You have to be comfortable with the people around you. You have to like the kind of work assigned to you. These things are very important. So I think keep that in mind. The other thing is that you should try to find a community of people who are supportive to you. It should be your advisor, but other than your advisor, your peers, your lab mates, friends, sometimes even outreach activities or other groups, student groups can be really helpful. And a lot of the times, especially, I think, if you're struggling with something, don't be afraid to reach out. You would be surprised at how many people will go out of their way to help you. But there are also a lot of resources on different campuses and different schools. depending on what kind of help you need, from simple academic advising to like if you have a problem with a professor or something like more serious, don't try to keep it to yourself. Be open about it and seek help for it as soon as possible.
Great. Yeah.
Our guest this week has been our lab mate, Maham Aftab. So thank you, Maham.
Thank you.
This has been the Spotlight Report. If you would like to comment or subscribe on today's episode or access more episodes of the Spotlight Report, please visit us at areainsights.com, where you can comment and subscribe and additionally access other resources that we provide, such as alternative podcasts and articles, etc. Thank you for listening.